Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Derek Harwell, who I've known for quite a while. I think you were in Italy the first time we met, I think.
No, in Amsterdam, actually.
Amsterdam, sorry, yeah. You came to the first ever Google Summit we organized in Prague in 2011 or 12 with John Micton.
Correct.
And then you went to work in Italy, I think, for a while, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I was a principal, middle school principal, and a PYP principal in Italy. So.
And the last time I saw you randomly was quite a few years ago when I happened to meet you at a Halloween party in Prague when you were dressed as a convict. That was quite a strange.
That's like, right.
Because you know when you see someone and it's out of context and you're thinking, I know that person from somewhere, but I can't remember where. And that was with you. I was like, well, I know. Where do I know him from? No, it's Derek. I know. You know, it got me.
Yeah, and it was quite interesting taking the tram to that party too because we were dressed as convicts. Yeah. And Halloween's not that big in Prague.
It's not big at
and
all.
And two police officers got on the tram and everybody started laughing. So
really?
it was a good time.
Yeah. By the way, there's I heard about this thing with policemen, which is just crazy. You know, there's a lot of stag party, bachelor parties and things. And there used to be a thing, I'm sure it's got banned, but they'd get like a fake, you could organize to get like a fake policeman, arrest your friend and put them in a cell. But it was all fake.
I remember that, yeah, exactly. Like, and they would grab you off the street.
And they'd kind of say they were going to beat them and torture them. And it's like crazy stuff. And I don't know how they got away with it, you know. I mean, it must have. I mean, you couldn't do that in the US, you know.
The lawsuits would be
coming out of your ears, you know. But
absolutely, yeah.
I want to talk a bit about Nepal, because Nepal's I'm looking forward to. We're running a summit together. We're running a Google summit together this fall. I'll get the dates. I should have had them to hand, actually, so I can mention it on the podcast.
It's the 20th, 21, 22 September.
Yeah, which is going to be an amazing event. Anyone who's we've got people coming in from India and Thailand. A lot of good flights from the Middle East as well. So check it out, Lincoln School. September the 20th, there's an educator boot camp, and then there's a summit 21st and 22nd. So it's a weekend and great chance to see Kathmandu. And I'm going back with the family, which is going to be amazing. And I wanted to talk a bit about Nepal. Like, how long have you been living there now?
So I'm going into my second school year. Yep. So I've been here for a full year. And a little bit like you, I know we talked about this before. I was here about 30 years ago, or a little over 30 years ago. And my biggest memory then was I got my boot stuck in mud and couldn't get it out. And so I had to walk barefoot for the rest of the trek.
Really?
So that was my memory of 30 years ago. And obviously trying to find shoes that fit me wasn't easy. But I wanted to come back. I was working for an organization called the Association for the Advancement of International Education, AAIE, and I was living in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I don't know if you've ever been, but it is just, it's just the, I don't know, the basket of just everything that I feel like international education is striving not to do. It's just opulent. They have several Rolls-Royce dealerships. It was just this so different lifestyle. I lived in Amsterdam for 20 years. I lived in Italy for a couple of years, and I've lived all over the world, but this was just such an opulent lifestyle. And I was like,
plus there's something about Florida that's a little bit crazy as well. Like, I don't know if you've seen that Twitter account, like Florida man says, like, it's just, if you hear like a crazy story, and there's a good chance it happened in Florida, you know, like there's a lot of just, I don't know what it is down there, but it's like, you know.
Yeah, it is. And I have a Florida driver's license, so I'm a Florida man now. Yeah. So if I do something stupid, I have an excuse. Yeah. And sorry, Florida. Yeah. But I wanted to go back to something real. I wanted to get back to a small school. And my school in Amsterdam was small when I joined it, and it became really big. I joined a school in Italy, which was quite small. And it's up and down all the time. It's Rome. So, you know, things fluctuate. So we have about 250 students here, K-12. So it's a very small school. We're celebrating our 65th anniversary this year. So it's been here for a long time. We do work closely with the Department of Overseas Schools and the American Embassy. So we have a lot of different types of students here. But when it comes right down to it, we have 15, 16, 17 kids in a grade level. So we can, when we want to do something, we want to make big change, we can make it really quickly. And that was kind of what I wanted to do when I came back into international schools after AAIE. I really wanted a school where we could make a big difference really quickly.
Yeah.
And one of the things here is like the 2015, they suffered this horrible earthquake. Yep. And the rebuilding has been going on. The school was fine. The school is safe. It's one of the safest places in Nepal to be during an earthquake. Had almost no damage here. So they were very lucky. I wasn't here at the time. And so hopefully we continue that kind of luck, you know? So it's a small school. It's not going to really grow. We are who we are, and we are what we want to be. So we're really happy.
Yeah.
But we've been isolated, and that was one of the reasons I reached out to you about doing a Google Summit, because a lot of the teachers are very interested in PD, but getting to PD from Kathmandu is not always easy. And we have a great association, NISA and SISA, that we belong to, and their schools have some wonderful PD. And I've been involved in school PD for a very long time. So I talked to the director, Benetta Ramsey, and said, why don't we host the PD? Yeah. And then we get to control it. So let's look at doing some of these things. So yours is going to be one of the first sessions that we've hosted. And we're really looking forward to it.
Great.
But as far as the school goes, it looks like it could house about 500, 600 students, but we have 250. So we have
a lot of space.
It's wonderful.
What's it like? I'm curious, like, to get into like, actually sort of day-to-day life living there. I mean, is it a pretty easy place? I know there's a lot of bureaucracy. Like when you get there, I guess the school probably helped you find accommodation and stuff. Was it pretty easy settling in, or was there a lot of visits to government offices and things?
You know what? No visits whatsoever. I did my visa when I was in Amsterdam and walked straight through the airport. No questions, nothing, and settled in just fine. Handed my passport over to our officer who took it down and got my stamps. So I have a year, and I do it every year. Tends to go just very easily. So everything is quite, a lot of places like this can be, like you said, convoluted and very heavy paperwork.
Yeah.
But all of it's, even if you're just traveling, you get a 10-day, 15-day visa, you print it out, you come in, you have to have a passport photo. That's the hardest thing. Make sure you have a passport photo. And you kind of just breeze through the lines of, wait for your luggage, and outside there's cabs and everything else. It's pretty good.
And what about living? Do most people, I mean, I remember, so when I was there, it was a bit less, it was probably, I've been there three times. I was there about 25 years ago. I did three treks. I did Everest, Annapurna, and Langtang. And I was, so 20, yeah. probably 20 to 25 years ago was the time I was there. And has it changed much in that time, do you think? Or was it, I mean, people say it's changed less than you think, you know, I'm sure it is different, but.
There's a, from 20 years ago or so, there's a picture of the Bodha Stupa, which used to be out in the rice fields and whatnot. And now you can't even see it because it's surrounded by housing and
Oh, really?
Buildings and everything. So there's been a huge influx of new building of people from around the valley and from people around the world, which has brought lots of different kind of cultural things that are great. So a lot of cultural celebrations, a lot of foods, opportunities that you wouldn't get in other places of the world. So there's some really nice benefits from the growth, but at the same time, traffic and your normal growth types of things that, you know, aren't good in large cities. So traffic is one of those. So mobility can be difficult. We're in a pretty nice place
most of the teachers live in apartments or houses, or how does it work?
Yeah, we pretty much live in apartments, and mostly we end up getting in a whole apartment building. We rent the whole apartment building to make sure that, you know, that we can look out for each other. It's a small group of teachers. There's only under 40, let me say that. I think it's about 36 teachers here. So it's a small group of people, close knit, and we kind of tend to, you know, hang out together, and we all several apartment buildings, I think, and there's another building that has, you know, five or so apartments. So we have several different buildings around the city. The school supplies the buses, and the buses are great for families and for the teachers. So it's one of our benefits is that we have transportation to and from school every day. And then, so that's very helpful as well.
I know when I was actually a friend of Mike's girlfriend's was manager of the Summit Hotel, so we stayed there, and it was interesting. We went out, so it was kind of interesting, you know. We got to have a bit more, you know. We stayed in Tamil, had the backpacker thing, and we also had a bit of a local scene. And I remember it was definitely very limited then. I remember there was like one Mexican restaurant, and there was, you know, a few like one of every, there was kind of one of everything, you know. And but what's it like social now? You mentioned that the teachers and the staff go out together. Like, is it pretty fun? Is it Tamil focused or different parts of town?
You know, it depends. Like when we were both here 25, 30 years ago, we were younger, and Tamil was going to be our place. It's a great place. But every city has a place like that that is streets lined with bars and souvenir shops and restaurants and all kinds of interesting things that cater to the tourists. And Tamil's a wonderful place for that.
Yeah.
Now, these days, I would kind of like to have a really nice place. So I tend to stay in Jamshikau, which has this place called Restaurant Road.
Right.
Has a lot of nice little trendy looking bars and interesting hole in the walls kind of bars, some local places, that kind of thing. Is kind of more suited to my speed these days. But there's something for everybody, and that's the nice thing about it. Tamil itself is certainly accessible, but again, that's heavy traffic. That's downtown.
Yeah.
You know, at night everything closes here quite early, except for Tamil. So if you go out late, you want to go out to Tamil.
Right.
So otherwise, like you mentioned, the Summit. There's plenty of things around the Summit now. I think you'd be surprised if you saw it.
There was nothing by the Summit. Literally, there was the Summit Hotel, and then there was just a bunch of houses, and then you had to drive to Tamil or whatever. That was it.
No, there's a whole row of bars. There's Mexican restaurants right near. A wonderful British pub. You know, if you want to watch football or anything else British, it's a great little British pub there. The British school is just down the street, just a tad from there.
That's
too.
Right.
So
yeah, I spoke to them years ago. I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, it's definitely bustling. And sits at the top of the hill, beautiful views. That's where we house some of our teachers when they come in at the first of the year. So new teachers and whatnot.
Right.
Till we have them all set up. So it's a great place.
No, yeah. Cool. Looking forward to it. I mean, Nepal's you know, it's such a beautiful place, especially Kathmandu. You know, you can see the mountains all around, and it's great. You know, I really looking forward to get back to it. It's great to fly into and see everything, you know.
It's beautiful to fly into. Yeah, it can take a while. We still only have the one runway.
Yeah.
So it can take a while. You have to. It's kind of nice because you do have to circle around, so you get to see everything.
Yeah.
And depending on where you're coming from, you sit on the left or the right hand side of the plane. You get to see the Himalayas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to look that up yourself.
Yeah.
I think from Europe, Europe it's the left hand side.
It's left side. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure of it. Yeah.
I'll be coming from Thailand. We're going to base ourselves in Bangkok for a while, so we're going to come out from Bangkok. So I'll be flying,
which is
I think daily. It may even be twice a day from Bangkok now. It used to be every day.
Well, there's Lion Air and there's several in Thai. Lion and Thai, and I think maybe Silk Air. I can't remember. There's several carriers.
It's surprisingly close. Yeah. It's only like, I think, 3.5 hours or 3 hours from Thailand, isn't it?
To 3 hours. Yeah. Not bad.
Great. So I want to talk about a few things about your background, actually. One thing I wanted to talk about first was the TEDx, which you were involved in, because I've had a few people ask me about running a TEDx, and I even looked at it myself. I was going to run one in Prague, and I remember I looked through the whole process, and just one of those things, I was just too busy to do it, you know, in the end. But and I know you were involved in a committee, and I'm just curious about anything you can remember about the process, about how you got, you know, how you got involved and how it worked with, you know, what kind of criteria you had to fulfill to be able to run a TEDx.
So that was right around the same time that we met. Yeah. So our first event, it was TEDx Amsterdam Ed. Yeah. So it looks like Amsterdammed when you okay, actually write it all out. But it was specifically for education. So the person who started it was Jessica Lynch. I worked with her on some other things. She kind of got started in something called Boom Chicago. It's a comedy club in Amsterdam where Seth Meyers and several other kind of famous people came from. And she was there with Seth and all of those. And we moved to Amsterdam around the same time in the early 90s. So we worked on some other programs and things, and she came up with this idea, and I was just going to help out. So I was one of the originators of working on it. We did the first one, and I don't remember the year, but if you say 2011 when we met, it was probably 2011. There's quite a bit that happens if you want to run a TEDx event. You just can't throw up a sign and call it TEDx. Yeah. You have to work with the team in California, and you have to work with some certain ground rules. And there's quite a few ground rules.
Yeah, you have to basically get permission done, and you have to fulfill certain criteria to be able to run it. Yeah.
Yeah, and typically there's a licensee. So there's a license that somebody who holds the license for your country. And Jim Stoltes is the person who holds the license for the Netherlands, because we were in Amsterdam. So we worked through him, got ours licensed.
Yeah.
All TEDx events are licensed through TED. So you do have to do that. And then from there, you work with production teams to, they allow a lot of creativity, but it has to be a certain red, it has to be a certain black, and it has to be a certain white. You have to follow the fonts, you have to do certain things.
Does each session have to be 5 minutes? Is it a fixed length of time, every talk?
No. That's kind of up to you. We ran some 7 minutes, some 18 minutes. I think we did a couple of 12 minutes. We had some musical things involved. We did it in the beautiful Concertgebouw in the center of Amsterdam. So we had some wonderful musicians who came from the Concertgebouw, and it was we have a great relationship with them. So that was just an added bonus. Yeah. Wonderful space. You know, it's a historical building anyway. I guess the other things that, you know, that you need to consider is when you run a TEDx event, you also have to show, and this could change and I could be wrong, but you have to show a couple of videos from another official TEDx event. So if you wanted to show a TED talk, an actual TED talk from California, you could do that. That could count as one of your three. We had to run three in every one of our events. So that's what we did. And that's another requirement. So,
right. Great. And in terms of, I think the money you can charge for the TEDx, but you're not supposed to make a profit. I think that's how it works, isn't it? That's like, I think it seemed quite vague, but that's how I understood it.
Yeah. Our first 2 years, we did not charge. Yeah. We got enough from, we definitely had enough sponsorship in the first couple of years to carry the whole thing without having to charge. But a lot of times if you don't charge, people don't always show up for free. So you want a little bit of money just to make sure that people are going to show up.
I've talked about this before quite a few times on the events podcast. Is you know, like we were saying about Nepal, you know, we want local teachers to come, but you know, I know this from experience in Thailand, for example, in the Bangkok summit, which I think you've been to. We offered Thai teachers, and we had 100 teachers sign up, and like 20 came. You know, and the dropout rate varies a lot depending on the event, but still, there's always a dropout rate, a big one if it's free.
Absolutely. And if it's free, you get what you pay for a lot of times too. So people don't always take it seriously. So I know that we charged, and we also, you know, we had a lunch. We did some interesting things for networking. And one of our lunches was, there were four different lunch boxes, and each one, so one lunch box would have four sandwiches, one lunch box would have four salads, one would have four desserts, and one would have four, I don't know, something else. And you had to find four other people who had a different box than you so that all of you could have a balanced lunch. So they had to, people had to walk around and do this kind of a networking event that we wanted them to do. Yeah. And then, you know, we also, they don't do this anymore because once you do it once, everybody knows, but we grouped people and they had to meet during one of the breaks, and they met and they had to figure out why we asked them pre questions, like, what's your favorite toothpaste? What's your favorite TV show? And we just, in the end, we just randomly put them together, and they had to figure out why they were put together. And there was no reason, but, you know, they thought it must be the toothpaste, and they were going through. So they got to know each other really well just from trying to figure out some of these things. And, you know, we admitted it at the end of the, at the end of the TEDx event.
That's a good thing. I think these icebreakers are great, and we're trying to incorporate them now in our opening and closing sessions. And I think it's good for anyone running events to think about this. It's just, rather than, you know, you can, I think running in a conference, whether it's for teachers or for any kind of audience, like, or any event, the biggest mistake I think you can make is being too academic about it. It's like, you know, you have the keynote, and then, you know, everyone sits in rows. And I think, you know, having something where people get up and meet each other is a really great way to kick things off. Or even just periodically through the day, because people get a bit sleepy and tired. And if you do exercises like this periodically, it wakes people up as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, most events now, we didn't have an app at the time, but most events now that I run, I would have an app. And, you know, lots of times you can just throw in a scavenger hunt or throw in something for extra points. And you're playing a game while you're also attending the conference. You know, photo competitions and lots of different things that, you know, that come with apps, or if you build your own app.
Yeah. Great. So, and how, like, in terms of running it, like, did you have a big team to run it, or did you keep it quite lean in terms of the actual running of the event?
Well, I would say there was about 10 people. So we had, you know, people who, the one nice thing is there's a hotel school in Amsterdam, a really nice hotel school in Amsterdam. So we recruited quite a few students from there who wanted to have something on their resume, for one. We couldn't afford to pay anyone, so everybody was kind of a paraprofessional and volunteer. So, you know, we got some really high expertise there. It was kind of an amazing, overwhelming how well prepared these kids were for going into hospitality. And they really outdid it. I mean, a lot of the ideas for breaks and things came from them. It was quite of an amazing thing. We also had some professionals who were in marketing and advertising, and we had some professionals who ran their own schools. And like I said, Jessica Lynch, who had her background at Boom Chicago, so she knows how to run events as well. So there was a lot of expertise in the room, but not so much with running a TED event. We also had this group called the New Verbalizers. So once we decided who our speakers would be, we reached out to them, and they helped everybody be able to tell their story in a way that was different, and in a way that was well rehearsed, and well, you know, that it was going to make sure that the message was clear that they were trying to provide.
This is a really important point. So that was very helpful. Coaching speakers. So you actually had a group called the New Verbalizers. So they were kind of a consultancy who helped people prepare to do public speaking and things. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's what they do. Yes. Yeah. And they're part of a marketing company as well, I believe. But yes, that was one of the one, quite a professional group that helped us. And I think they volunteered their time just to make sure that the thing got off the ground and did really well. All of that is, of course, on that website for TEDx Amsterdam. The very first year is definitely there.
And how did you promote it? Like, what was behind the promotion of the event? How did you get people to come, especially to the first event, which is always the hard one?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Amsterdam's not a big city, so very close knit. So a lot of word of mouth. But we also did a huge advertising campaign with the, you know, the people who do the street signs. I cannot think of their name, but they were very helpful in providing us free space for a good chunk of time to advertise at the TEDx Amsterdam. And also the Concertgebouw has a huge list of very important movers and shakers and that type of thing from Amsterdam themselves. So they helped with our reach out campaign too.
So you weren't, even though it was a TEDx EDU, you weren't just focusing on teachers, you were focusing on getting a range of people there.
That's correct, because we don't think education only happens in schools. That was the big part of it. You know, it's one of those ideas that for education to be valued, everyone in the community must value it. And that's a really important thing. However, Dutch culture is kind of interesting here because Dutch culture says, don't stand out. Yeah. You know, be normal. There's this, gewoon, be normal. Don't stand out. So even if you're a billionaire, your house looks like crap because you don't want to stand out. And so here we are trying to raise the level of education in a country that says, yeah, don't stand out. So, yeah. You know, the way that you have to go about doing something like that is interesting too, because we want people to be high achieving, but not without the notoriety. You know, we're not looking for awards. We're not looking for those types of things. So, I think Stan Putman, who was 18 years old or 17, I think at the time, was one of our first speakers, said it well because he went to TEDx Amsterdam and said, you know, it was gray. There wasn't a head in the room that wasn't gray. And those are not who are going to be your education. People who are going to shake up education or disrupt education are probably not gray. They can be, but probably not gray. Their education and what these kids need are so far apart. So what they remember from school. But, you know, we had Anton Phillips speak as well, the heir of Phillips electrical components, yeah. Medical components now. He spoke, and I mean, he said he didn't even start living until he was in his late 80s. He didn't even understand what education was or what he knew and what he didn't know until he was in his late 80s. So it's not really the gray. It was just the graying of the ideas.
Sure.
And whether or not you had the best people in the room. And that was one of our, you know, it was selective at the end because we didn't just take everybody who wanted to come. We had more people wanting to come than we had seats. So we had to be selective in why we wanted them.
That's a great situation to be in. Yeah, that means you did your job right in terms of, you know, like it's good to promote it and let people know there's scarcity because that makes people more keen to come when they know there's a limited number of places. You know, it increases the interest.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So, yeah, well, obviously we zoomed in on the TEDx. I'm really keen to just get into your background because, like, it's quite interesting. It'd be just good to fly through the countries you've worked in because you've had a mix of, obviously, you know, we first met, you were working for international schools and then you went to work for some organizations. Presume you missed working for a school again and came back. Like, where did you start off working and what countries and places have you worked in?
Well, at my non-education side, I worked in Central America, in Guatemala and Honduras when I was young. And then that kind of got me interested in more international. I went back to the U.S., became a teacher, stayed in the U.S. for about 3 years, got my teaching credentials all set, you know, and learned some innovation things. My background, I wanted to be in middle school. And the reason I did is because in middle school is when I made my decision I was not going to graduate high school. And I did not graduate high school. Really? I dropped out. Yeah. And I hated it. I didn't enjoy it at all. I dropped out. I went, I was taking AP classes at the time, which would convert into a year or so of university courses. And I went to a community college and finished up some things, transferred into Virginia Tech. So by the time I was 18, I was actually graduating from Virginia Tech. And the bursar said, well, we don't have a copy of your high school diploma. And I said, well, I don't have one. So I had to take a GED really quickly before I could graduate from the university.
Right.
Because it's a requirement. So I did that. And then from there, and I went to Appalachian State because I wanted to focus on middle school. And that's always been my passion. It's always been my focus. So I took the job in Amsterdam in the early 90s. And I stayed there for a little over 20 years and moved on from there to Italy for a couple of years where I was the PYP principal in the middle and the M. And at the moment, it was middle school principal, but it became an MYP school while I was there. That was one of the things that the owner director of the school really wanted for it to be an MYP school. So that was one of the things that I had to do. And then from there, I did the AAIE. Where I was the program director. AAIE is for directors of international schools and leadership of international schools. So it was a nice opportunity for me to take a different step in running a school as opposed to teaching in a school. All of my other PD things that I had run in the past, Elmley and other things that I've done, have always been focused on the classroom education, and AAIE helped open my mind to leadership in education.
Yeah, what events do they run? Because I was actually looking at attending one or two of their events. They had some events in the US and I think some in Central America. It just never worked out with the dates and things, but what type of events for teachers do they run?
Well, it's leadership. AAIE is leadership. So yeah. It's usually, a lot of it has been child protection in the past few years, because that's been a big key component that schools were not doing so well. And now with COIS, the Council of International Schools, and some other organizations who have really upped the game on child protection. So that's been one of the big things. Advancement and marketing was another one that we would do summer interns or summer workshops for people in those organizations. And that was a big one as well. And so different things year long, but the big conference is in a big city, either San Francisco or New York, sometimes DC, sometimes just Chicago. It's been going on for a little over 50 years. And it's four directors. It's surrounded by, on either side, either weekend of the conference itself, is a hiring fair. So ISS and CERCH on either weekend, typically. So it helps the directors meet up. They talk about, especially like the director of somewhere like Kathmandu, where our director, Vanetta Ramsey, doesn't have a school nearby. Whereas in Amsterdam, there were several international schools nearby where they could talk about issues about, say, the government's doing a tax on this, or the government's doing that, or won't let us import this, or we have this security concern. Yeah. So her best bet to have that kind of discussion with other directors only, not just leadership, but really directors, would be at AAIE. She has NISA, for example, which is in Bangkok this year, NISA Leadership, where she can talk to other school leaders, principals, directors, also about different issues that we may have. But AAIE is directors, and you know, it's not just directors, it is leadership, but it's historically been directors.
Right.
So it's one of those good opportunities for them to be able to discuss what it's like to be a director of a school. And I know that wellness is another big factor that's new to international schools. And, you know, it doesn't really hit your school until the director decides this is important for my school. And I know that Bonetta, once again, has it from a lot of places, but I think AAIE was imperative for her creating the position here for a director of wellness, not only for students, but also for the staff. So it's very important. We take that very seriously here too.
That's interesting. Director of wellness. I've never really heard of that.
It's an important, we think it's very important. It's as important as director of curriculum or any other principal. It's a very important job because, you know, if you're not well, if you're not happy, you're not going to be, your students are not going to be learning from you, and your students can't learn if they're not well. So it's an important job. We also, you know, we do have some natural issues here. It is an earthquake zone. We do have some air quality things in the winter time. Right now it's kind of nice. By the time of the conference, it's still super nice. But during the winter, people burn, to stay warm, that kind of thing. So our air quality deteriorates. So that's one of the things that the director of wellness makes sure, that indoor play on those bad days and that kind of thing as well.
Right. Great. Yeah. So obviously from the US to Nepal. And
right.
And how long do you think you stay in Nepal? I mean, I honestly, like, I think it's such a great place. I could, I know it's a place where everyone I know has lived there and has left has wanted to go back. That's the strange thing about it.
Yes.
People have enough of it, of the craziness, and then they're like, as soon as they leave, they want to go back there. You know, it's funny.
That's how I felt over the summer. I was in wonderful, predictive Germany where everything works. And that was awesome. I really enjoyed it. You know, the doors actually closed when you close them. And then I get back here and everything's a little quirky, and I missed it because when everything works, you just take it for granted. And here it's, you have to work a little bit. When things work here, they work well. When things don't work, it can be a little more complicated.
Yeah.
The people here are wonderful and friendly. And we have this wonderful person here at school, Regina Tapa, who does a lot of our cultural training. And she tells that people in Nepal treat their guests as gods because they believe they are. And I have felt that kind of treatment here. I feel like people take very, very good care of us. The local people here are just wonderful, and service is amazing, and you know, everybody is friendly. It is chaotic. You know, there is traffic. I bike to school in the traffic, and I dodge cows, and I get chased by a dog, and I'm whipping in and out of traffic just like anybody, just like a local. So it's
pretty brave.
It's a wonderful, it's a wonderful experience. It's exactly what I wanted. So I think I'll be here. This is my second year going into. So I think I'll be here a couple more years for sure, because it really just the school itself is exactly what I wanted. And the city is amazing. The views, see the Himalayas from our rooftop. It's just a stunning place.
Great. Well, look, Darren, that's really cool. I think one final thing. You mentioned before that you've spoken at a lot of events, ISTE and a bunch of other conferences. And do you have any kind of tips, anything for people that want to speak at events, how to get to do it, how to put together good presentations, and anything that you've learned in your experience, you know, getting to speak at these events?
I think courage. I think that's the first thing you have to present. You have to make the proposal and then do it. And I've encouraged so many people who have come back to me and said, that is the best professional development I've ever done, because I had to organize my notes. I had to organize my thinking. I had to really meditate on what it is I do in the classroom that I want to that I feel worthy to share. And that, to me, that's one of the biggest thing is consider it a PD opportunity. Do not consider it you bragging about something you've done or bragging about your school or drawing attention to yourself. It's not that at all. It's definitely sharing practice is one of the best PDs you'll ever do. So that's one thing. The other thing is getting other people involved. If you do something in isolation, it's not worth doing. So if I was going to present, I would have three or four people brainstorming ideas with me. I would open up a Google Doc and we would put some things on it and how I wanted to bring something in and how I was going to talk about this. Yes, in the end, I would be the person presenting it, or maybe we would do a group presentation. But if I was the one presenting it, it can't just be my voice. It can't just be about me. It's got to be about other people. So I think that collaboration is key to making a very good presentation. And of course, bouncing ideas and practicing it with others is very helpful as well. Yeah. And again, putting students on that same team with you and getting their input is important too.
And yeah, that's great advice. One thing I'd add to that is don't be discouraged if you don't get accepted. You know, I mean, I've applied to speak at plenty of places that said no. And, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the great things about running my own business, running apps events, is that, like, when you run a business, like, it's completely different to having a job in terms of you just suffer constant rejection, and it's great. You know, I think running your own business, having a sales job, there's a few things you can do in life that, like, you know, like, I know some teachers are like, oh, I got ISTE said no, and that's it. You know, and I'm like, you know, I get rejected like 10 times a day, because if you run a business, you're always trying things, and people say no, and then you just get used to, you know, running into the door, and eventually you're going to go through it, you know?
Yeah. You know, my very first time in North Carolina as a teacher, I applied to this conference to present, didn't know much about it, but my principal really encouraged me to do it. And I said, sure. And then Al Gore, who was the vice president at the time, was also going to be there. And I was super excited because I wanted to hear him speak. Of course, with his job, he got pulled away quickly. And they said, Derek, we're bumping you to the keynote. You're going to replace Al Gore for the keynote.
No pressure then.
No pressure. And I was 23 years old in my first year of teaching. Wow. And I did a lot of work back then with Roger Wagner and Hyper Studio. So a lot of my presentation was Hyper Studio and using the writing process through telling media stories and different things like that. So I was lucky because my school had video cameras, had some early on Mac computers that had video boards in them so that we could do things with video, and had all kinds of language learning happening. it was quite exciting, I think, for the time. But yeah, I was not, I had maybe, we all had to have handouts, and I maybe had 20, and there were about a little over 1500 people in the room.
Okay.
So no handouts. They just had to sit back and listen.
Wow.
And I will tell you, the tech failed at one part. The tech failed, and I made a big joke of it. You know, like, you thought I was going to be slick or something. I mean, tech fails on you. This stuff happens.
That's another thing I tell every presenter, is that get ready for the internet to go down. And maybe you just, and you know what, it's happened to me. You know, I've run so many events, and I've presented, I don't present as much as I used to, actually. It's going to be great. Nepal's going to be the first time I presented in quite a while, but I've had everything happen. And you know what I think is, like, especially in kind of something for educators, like a smaller event, if the internet goes, it's like, right, we're having a roundtable discussion. You know, we sit around in a circle, and I'm going to lead the discussion. We're going to talk about the topic, you know? And it works. People often have a better time than if I'd done the original presentation, you know?
That's true. Yeah, yeah. Because everybody in the room has something that they can add, you know? So it's a great thing. As long as you get them started with something. Yeah. Otherwise, it's silence.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, Derek, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Looking forward to meet in, I guess, probably coming up to...
About a month
now. Yeah. One month.
1 month. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Great.
Time's
fast. I'm looking. It's been a while, Dan. So I'm looking forward to seeing you too.
And I know. Yeah. I've got a child and a wife now, so things have changed. So looking forward to meet up, and we'll go out for dinner and a few drinks in Nepal as well. So it should be good.
Absolutely. All right. Get you some Gorkha beers.
That's great. Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. All right, man. Thanks.